Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
Get around the radio, kids. It's time for Strictly Confidential. It's the homosexual agenda on steroids, putting the dominionists and the loyal Bushies and the rest of America's underbelly on notice that the GLBT community is simply not going to take it anymore. So, just like gay kryptonite, here's Peter Godbold.
Good evening, America, and good morning, world. And what, to my wondering ears, did appear, seconds before the start of the show, the front doorbell. One wonders who is at the door, but I certainly cannot get up and go check to see. I suppose if it's urgent, they will kick the door in. In any case, welcome to Book, Chapter, and Verse 143 of Strictly Confidential. I am Peter Godbold, and welcome to the LGBT version of Conversation Radio, in touch with the LGBT community and our straight allies. Strictly Confidential is found exclusively on the listener-supported Head On Radio Network, also brought to you in part by Coal River Mountain Watch. That's CRMW.net, Coal River Mountain Watch. Stop by CRMW.net and see what mountaintop removal is doing to West Virginia. Thank you for making Strictly Confidential a part of your day. Today is, in fact, Thursday, May the 8th, 2008. So if you're listening shortly after 9 p.m., let's see, it's about 9:03 Eastern Time on a Thursday, that is May the 8th, you're listening to a live show, and you are welcome to phone in and talk with myself and to the guest who will be joining us at the bottom of the hour. By the way, the guest is Jim Burroway, and he is the editor of Box Turtle Bulletin. I couldn't be happier to have Jim on the show. His site is devoted to analyzing statements and scientific claims of ex-gay and anti-gay organizations. And we've used his site as a resource many times. In fact, you've heard me say, gee, I ought to get that guy on the show. Well, we've finally done it. The show site is strictlyconfidentialradio.com, and there you're going to find links to all of the guests, as well as to the audio archives from the past shows, as well as to the chat room. There are also links there for Strictly Confidential's MySpace page and links to help you locate the music that you hear on the show. You'll find there also a Head On Radio Network main site link, and there you can find out about all of the other progressive programming on the Head On Radio Network, of which I am only a small part. You will find there also a PayPal button to make it easier for you to support the Head On Radio Network. To participate, this is Conversation Radio. You can dial in toll-free at 877, the number 4, head-on. That translates into 877-443-2366. If you have unlimited long distance, please use that and save the studio a nickel or a buck. That's area code 304-658-3333. That's 304-658-3333. And that rings in West Virginia. Email arrives to Peter at headonradionetwork.com. That's Peter at headonradionetwork.com. And I do try to check the email during the breaks. So you have several ways to participate. You can join us in the chat room. You'll find the link there at the homepage, strictlyconfidentialradio.com. It's a good night to join. There are people participating and lots of banter going on. You can call in, either toll-free or toll if you have unlimited, and you can email us. So there's plenty of ways to participate. I'll give those numbers out again when we have our guest Jim Burroway join us at the bottom of the hour. By the way, the doorbell has stopped ringing, but boy, it rang and rang and rang. Doggy looked up and began. She knows, Doggy knows that the doorbell means someone's at the door, which is a rare occurrence here on the dirt road in the middle of nowhere, so we do not know who is there, but we are curious. But perhaps we'll find something fun on the doorstep when we open it. But that is a contingency I never planned for. It's so completely out of the ordinary. I normally unplug the phone so that we don't have the phone ringing in the background. But I never thought to disable the doorbell. But anyway. Let's see, where should we begin? I know chat room tells you it was a Latter-day Saints. It's a little late for you guys to be showing up, shove a microphone in their face. Let's see here. I received, this all started with an email today. I received a wonderful email from Jay. She is one of our listeners, and Jay is commenting on the partly on the Hagee story that we did the other evening. She always writes an interesting email. She's first comments about Reverend White. She says, "I'm finding that I like Reverend Wright," and I have to agree with her. She says, "Of course, I don't agree with all of his conclusions, but I can understand how he got there." She then makes the interesting observation that caused her to think about what would have happened if all of the good white Christians back in the days in emancipation had invited the black community to join them in their churches. Well, the good white Christians would, of course, train them to sit in the back and be very, very quiet and fold their hands and bow their heads in proper Protestant prayer. And she says, in this respect, the segregation was almost a gift, and what it produced was a vibrant black church, and it developed and brought the world the gifts of gospel and blues. In fact, she's right there. It's an interesting perspective. She also writes that she has a suggestion for the United Methodist Church. We've been talking about the embarrassment of having the George W. Bush Library there at Southern Methodist University, and one of our guests just last week brought us the great news of the rejection of that library. It's still not all, the T's are not all crossed and I's dotted. Nonetheless, Jay suggests, that to save the embarrassment of being identified with Southern Methodist University, perhaps the church should simply change its name. She suggests perhaps Southern Conservative University or the University of Academic Illusion. She says that's a little hard to say, but put it in a football chair, it might be possible. Jay goes on to enclose a story regarding John Hagee and no less than Rod Parsley. Well, it's a new detail about Rod Parsley that I did not know. Of course, we covered the cesspool called John Hagee last night. We had various audio clips describing the right-wing fundamentalist pastor, so-called, that says the homosexuals destroyed New Orleans with the hurricane, and that the Catholic Church is a whore, among many other wonderfully enlightened comments. We waded through that cesspool rather deeply last night. And lo and behold, in today's email from Jay, I find that our friend Rod Parsley, now I first found out about Rod Parsley, several months ago. It was Bob Kincaid who first told me about Rod Parsley. He had flown under my radar somehow for quite some time. Rod told me that he was also a rabid right-winger. To give you more information, if you don't know, he's a televangelist from a mega church in Ohio. And he hates Islam, and he hates homosexuals, and he is against the separation of church and state. He wants a theocracy, and he compares Planned Parenthood to the Nazis. Well, we pretty much know those things about the fundamentalist preachers, but here's what's happened. Brand new, caught me off guard today. John McCain has actively sought and now received Parsley's endorsement, in addition to Hagee's endorsement for the presidential race. McCain has called Parsley his spiritual guide. Bob, let's go ahead and run the Rod Parse, the audio. Let's give the listeners a taste of Rod Parse.
Islam is an anti-Christ religion that intends through violence to conquer the world.
And I'm very honored today to have one of the truly great leaders in America, a moral compass, a spiritual guide, Pastor Rod Parsley, who is here.
The fact is that America was founded. I'm going to stagger you right now. Now, America was founded in part with the intention of seeing this false religion destroyed. Muhammad received revelations from demon spirits, not from the living God.
I want to say thank you for being here. I want to thank you for, Rob, for your kind introduction.
America has historically understood herself to be a bastion against Islam in the world.
For your leadership and your guidance, I'm very grateful you're here, sir.
In fact, I'll tell you this. I do not believe our nation can truly fulfill its divine purpose until we understand our historical conflict with Islam.
And I want to assure you, he should be talking, not me.
When it comes to Islam, now the greatest religious enemy of our civilization in the world, it's dangerous.
We were built for the battle. We were created for the conflict. We get off on warfare.
Now, before we go any further, I need to let you know that that film, that was a capture of the audio from a film done by Brave New Films. Our friends over at Brave New Films developed and edited that video, which consists mainly of Rod Parsley making those statements and of John McCain walking on the stage. Deeply grateful for Parsley's endorsements, and thanks from you folks over at Brave New Films. I was appalled. I was struck speechless. That, in fact, we love war. We were born for battle. I was completely taken aback by this new, even more powerful, extra double-strength version of Pastor Hagee. Now, the for-profit media will not and will never ask John McCain if he agrees with Parsley's vicious anti-Islam views. They are paid large amounts of money to not ask those questions and to protect the right wing and the Republicans. If you don't believe it, just listen to the questions they ask. There is never an attempt to get to the heart of the matter, whereas in the case of Reverend Wright, the media actively sought him out for his comments regarding being the pastor for Obama. Now, the speech that you just heard from Parsley sounds indeed very much like a speech that you would hear from Osama bin Laden, perhaps, or one of the Taliban leaders, one of the folks issuing a fatwa against the LGBT community in Iraq or Iran. It's violent, and it deviates so far from the simple message of the brown-skinned carpenter we call Jesus that my mind was just rocked. McCain sought the endorsement from this deeply bigoted pastor, and since the for-profit media will never address this issue, either Hagee or McCain, or his relationships together there with Parsley, will never be addressed. It's left to us to talk about and get the word out on these issues. As I said, it left me speechless. I happened to talk to our friend Larry Sanders today by telephone and also by email, and Larry very quickly put it into perspective for me. He brought up the story of the wheat and the tares and the fact that the Bible, in fact, in Matthew, in fact, Jesus' words in one of the parables tells us that the wheat and the tares should grow up together, and that it is, in fact, God who sorts the wheat from the tares. Some of you may know this story as the wheat, the chaff and the wheat, or separate the chaff from the wheat. The chaff is, of course, the husk. Tares are a sort of a weed that are found in Syria and other locations. Syria and, let's see, I have another country here. Here we go. It grows in Syria and Palestine, the tare, and it grows in with the wheat. And in fact, it is a ryegrass and looks very, very similar to wheat when it's growing together. And it is not until the wheat begins to form its ear can anyone really tell the difference between the wheat and the tares. And in fact, well, I'll give you the verse from the NIV and from an email from DJ Larry Sanders. Here's from the NIV. Jesus told them another parable. The kingdom of heaven is like a man who sowed good seed in his field. But while everyone was sleeping, his enemy came and sowed weeds amongst the wheat and went away. When the wheat sprouted and formed heads, then the weeds also appeared. The owner's servants came to him and said, "Sir, did you sow good seed in your field, and where did the weeds come from?" "An enemy did this," the owner replied. The servants asked him, "Do you want us to go pull them up?" Parsley is in favor of war and heading out to pull up those damnable Islam Muslims that he hates so intensely. "No," answered the owner of the field, "because while pulling the weeds, you may root up the wheat with them. Let both grow together until harvest, and at that time I will tell my harvesters, 'First collect the weeds and tie them into bundles to be burned, then gather the wheat and bring it to my barn.'" In Larry's email, he writes, "Those who claim to represent Christ, Rod Parsley, and at the same time call for the destruction of Islam are no more than wolves in sheep's clothing. Rod Parsley states, 'We were built for battle. We were created for conflict, and that we get off on warfare.' Like Hitler, he's hypnotized hundreds of thousands to follow his Antichrist message, including John McCain. If you really were an ordained messenger and minister for the Most High God while calling for the destruction of Islam, then shouldn't his message be, 'Let the righteous and the unrighteous grow together side by side until Christ returns at the end of the age.'" That's Matthew 13:30. "And if he believes Islam to be an enemy of Christ's church, then shouldn't he echo Christ's own words, 'Love your enemies and pray for those who would persecute you,' Matthew 5:44. Now, Larry says, "It's true that Rod Parsley may disguise his words as spiritual. We were built for battle. We were created for conflict. We get off on warfare. But I ask you, how spiritual can they be when he's aligning himself with a person who's bent on obliterating millions of lives for 100 years to come instead of letting the righteous and the unrighteous live side by side until Christ returns? I ask you, who's the sheep and who's the wolf in sheep's clothing? Well said, Larry. And in the last sentence, he's referring to a meeting in New Hampshire when John McCain, in front of a crowd, was asked by the interviewer, "President Bush has talked about our staying in Iraq for 50 years, and McCain cut the question off. He was so excited to answer and blurted out, "Make it 100. McCain has clearly stated to make it 100. And indeed, the righteous and unrighteous live side by side. The Buddhists and the Baptists and the Christians and the Muslims and the Jews and the Gentiles and the blacks and the whites and the gays and the straights, and the atheists, the evangelicals, and the Wiccans. Let us all live side by side, as we were told, not this fake piece of trash in a suit bellowing at a megachurch somewhere in Ohio, who, again, a candidate for the United States of America, has begged his endorsement, and the endorsement has been given. And as the case with Hagee, the for-profit media will never ask Mr. McCain these questions. How much of it does he believe? They will not ask, because to ask would separate McCain from the powerful base of voters that both of these men represent. They will never ask the questions either about Parsley. These questions are forbidden by the for-profit press and are asked here. So I wanted to close off that journey through the cesspool that we took last evening and give you what I hope to be the last chapter of that. Thank you, Larry Sanders, for writing us and talking to me about that today. I get it now. That's where the pastor deviates from the true word. And thank you, Jay, our dear listener, who told us who brought the story to my attention to begin with. And thank you to the folks again at Brave New Films for the video that we captured the audio from to use during this segment. Inquiring minds want to know. We'll be bringing on Jim Burrows or attempting to contact him around 9:30, so we actually have a few minutes before we do that, and we'll cover a few more things. He actually told us about 9:30, so he may be on his way home. We'll try right at 9:30. If we don't get him, we'll try again shortly after. I'm going to tell you a story about Carla Thomas Smith. Carla was arrested last month. She was arrested for registering to vote. I'll repeat that. Carla Thomas Smith was arrested last month for registering to vote and casting ballots in November 2004 and November 2006, according to the Leaf Chronicle. She's a Tennessee resident who was released on bond and was charged with accessory after the fact in a 1995 felony conviction. Now, this 1995 felony conviction, even though she is released, even though she has paid her debt for society, has disqualified her from voting in the state of Tennessee. Currently, Tennessee law bans those convicted of a felony with a maximum sentence of more than a year, with the possibility, read that, doesn't exist, but yet the state will tell you there's a possibility of reinstatement. It requires practically a pardon from the governor. Those who are convicted of murder and some sexual offenses and treason and voting fraud permanently lose their right to vote. And the law, of course, disenfranchises those with felony offenses who have outstanding legal financial obligations, example, restitution or child support fees, which, of course, means that the poor who cannot pay these debts are excluded from voting. We're going to go into a lot of detail about that probably tomorrow evening. Another example here, two citizens, and actually they're students at Amherst College. One is on the inside and able to vote, the other on the outside. Well, they've been rallying for a disenfranchisement reform in a co-authored opinion editorial published by the Boston Globe. He says, we both write the same papers, we read the same material, we're equally engaging in debate and discussion, and we discuss everything from the role of a good citizen to America's role in the world. There is no reason to think inmates are uniquely unqualified to vote. There is no reason. There's just no reason. The class meets in the Hampshire County Correctional Facility. It combines the college students with the inmates in a prison. There are more than 25,000 inmates there in Massachusetts and in prison jail. Now, this is a countrywide problem. We're not going to just talk about Tennessee and Massachusetts. The state is refusing to cooperate with integrating formerly incarcerated individuals into society. This goes back to the old Jim Crow laws, which we'll talk about, and why they, well, example, one of the things we're going to talk about when we get into the story, I expect tomorrow evening in depth, is the fact that back in the day, when the black folks were arrested, while they were incarcerated, they were leased out or handed out to the plantation owners. So you see, slavery continued back in those days. It's just that the slavery went on in such a way as to be in chains from the state rather than in chains from the slave owner. And it was in the state's best interest to prevent black folks from voting. And, of course, the felony laws are unequally enforced. There are a lot more black folks in jails than in prison percentage-wise. We know these things. But the national scandal is that, well, what if 5.3 million more Americans were able to vote by removing these people from the voting registration and emphasizing the Jim Crow roots that bars voters from voting? It's permanent disenfranchisement on people of color. And we'll be talking about that ripple effect. It not only impacts those who are unable to vote and who lose their voting right, entire communities lose their political force when their citizens can't vote. You deny one person to vote in a community, and it decreases the power of any political group to vote. And in fact, it is a fact that children many times learn their responsibilities to vote by following what their moms and dads did, driving to the voting precinct with them and seeing mom and dad vote. Well, if mom and dad don't vote, well, you see the spiral. Voting rights is a key component, and that's going to be an interesting series when we get to that. I'm thinking we're going to get to that tomorrow evening. I certainly hope so. A short story while Bob is looking for our guest. This particular story I found humorous when I first ran through it. It wasn't until the last paragraph that I became aware of how actually sad it is and heartbreaking it is. It's a phenomenon that I have seen amongst the poor, especially the homeless, and that is to commit various crimes, especially when there's cold weather, just so they can get into jail where there's at least a meal and where at least it's warm. Prison populations tend to go up as the weather gets cold, or rather jail populations, as the homeless who are desperate commit minor crimes to get themselves arrested. The story goes, the police say that a man dressed as a woman repeatedly crashed his car into a suburban Detroit lingerie store that had refused to hire him earlier this year. Well, you can see where I might have seen some humor in that. Dressed as a woman crashing into a lingerie store because they wouldn't hire him. Yeah, I had a grin there. Well, his name is Jeremy McIntosh, 27, and he was arrested Saturday night outside the Intimate Ideas store in Commerce Township. It's about 25 miles from Detroit. And damage to the store was estimated at about $3,000. The arresting officer said he was wearing facial makeup and lipstick and blue capri pants, flowery blouse, and matching flowery bra. And at that point, McIntosh told the deputies that he's homeless, he was living in his car, and he wanted to go to jail because he had nowhere else to go. Isn't America grand? He was jailed, of course, and is going to be arraigned on the malicious destruction of property and reckless driving. McCade does not have an attorney. He will be represented by a public defender, no doubt. That's a story that started out, I thought I would be able to present it to you with great humor. And as it turns out, it's not at all funny. I see now that we have our guest on the line, and I'm thrilled to have him with us this evening. And just looking here for my... Yes, here it is. Pardon the delay. It was a most unusual day today, and... What with the doorbell ringing just as I was going on the air, my papers are not exactly in the same order as they would normally be in. But in any case, forget all that. I am thrilled to have Jim Burraway with us this evening on the show. As I've mentioned to you several times in the past, Jim Burraway is the editor, actually the founding editor of the Box Turtle Bulletin, and it is a website devoted to analyzing the statements and scientific claims of ex-gay and anti-gay organizations to give you a reminder when we did the story about the anti-gay, how to write an anti-gay pamphlet, and what was it, 12, 15 steps? That was from Box Turtle. When we began doing the stories on Watchmen on the Walls, that was from Box Turtle. There are others. Well, Jim founded Box Turtle Bulletin in 2005 when he discovered how often anti-gay and ex-gay groups mischaracterize scientific research to advance their own political aims. That's politely said, mischaracterizes, as we all know, outright lying. Sometimes the claims find their way into the mainstream media, as we found out in the How to Write an Anti-Gay Pamphlet, and the media outlets never challenge this misinformation. Jim was astonished at how easy it was just to go to a public library and look up the source information firsthand, and he decided to fill in a critical need by providing a forum where comparisons between anti-gay claims and actual research can be presented in an easily accessible, no-nonsense fashion. Now, Jim's also attended many anti-gay conferences to witness these statements firsthand made by anti-gay leaders. He attended the Family Impact Summit in Tampa, which we covered here in the show. I'll be interested to hear what it really looked like from Jim this evening. He attended Love One Out Ex-Gay Conference, which was a focus on the family and Exodus International event. And he also went to the 2007 Exodus International Freedom Conference in California. And he's also presented workshops on Love One Out at the Ex-Gay Survivors Conference in California and at local PFLAG chapters. Jim makes his home in Tucson, Arizona, with his partner, Chris. So with no further ado, I'd like to welcome Jim Burraway to the show. Welcome, Jim.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's a thrill to have you here. I must say, we've talked about you. If your ears have been burning, we've mentioned you more than once in the past. And in fact, your site has been gold in terms of finding in-depth research to present on this show, as you might well imagine. With 2 hours of radio every evening, 5 days a week, one cannot possibly do one's own research. And so I formally say to you, and with great gratitude, that we have relied on you heavily. And we're just delighted to have you. Can you hear me okay, Jim? I want to check the volume levels.
I do. Yeah, I can hear you fine.
Excellent. Now, if that changes at all, just let us know, and the studio can... They have plenty of knobs and dials, and they can fix that right up. Jim, we always give out the call-in numbers in case any of our listeners would like to call in. The toll-free line is 877, the number 4-HEAD-ON. That's 877-4-HEAD-ON. Or if you have unlimited long distance, you can use that and save the studio a nickel or a buck. That's area code 304-658-3333. Rings in West Virginia, 304-658-3333. Or you can email us at peter@headonradionetwork.com if you'd like to talk to myself and to the guest. Jim, how does one go from childhood to writing perhaps the best, most in-depth LGBT research blog or site on the web? Where are you from, Jim?
Well, I grew up in a small town. Right where Ohio, Kentucky, and West Virginia meet. So I'm not that far from where your outfit originates there in Beckley, West Virginia. And so if anybody is listening from that area, as you well know, when I was growing up in the 70s, well, as far as I knew, there was, you know, maybe a few thousand gay people in New York City, another couple hundred or thousand or so in San Francisco, and maybe a few hundred spread around the rest of the country, but most of them were in jail, you know. So that was all I knew about gay people when I was growing up.
I see.
I came out late in life. I didn't come out to other people until I reached about the age of 40. So, and a lot of that had to do with a lot of the baggage that I picked up along the way about what it meant to be gay. You know, when you absorb the messages that are out there in the culture, it takes a long time to shed those messages. So what I saw after I had come out was a, you know, sort of a burning need for a resource for people to go to when they do have these questions about things that they've heard their pastor say or their friends say or their teachers say. Where can they go to find out more information and then, oh, by the way, find out that those things that they heard weren't true? And so that's why I founded Box Turtle Bulletin. And I am always gratified whenever I do get emails or when I meet people in person and they tell me how important Box Turtle Bulletin was for their own coming out. And I've had several people tell me that, and that's very gratifying to me because it's sort of the, you know, if we had had an internet in the 1970s, it's the sort of resource that I would have really have benefited from.
Well, Jim, I first let me tell you that in production, Bob Kincaid at the studio in West Virginia mentions to me that his wife, Agnes, is from Huntington, West Virginia.
Okay. Yeah.
It is a small world.
I wanted
to tell you, too, that I, too, grew up back in those days. I remember when I was in high school, I finally went to the high school library and pulled out Encyclopedia Britannica to look up homosexuality because I couldn't find anywhere in history that we were mentioned. I couldn't find anywhere in literature. It's as if we didn't exist. I figured there were maybe three or four around, you know, growing up in around Tallahassee, you know, and you hear the rumors about the, you know, bus stations and all this stuff, and you just, but you never see any. It was a terrible darkness.
Well, it was, and you know, you mentioned bus stations and parks and stuff, and you know, when I was growing up, I didn't want anything to do with that, and then you know, I would also hear these statistics. Well, you know, gay people have on average 500 partners a year, and I just thought, oh, good Lord, who wants that? Well, maybe some people do, but, and you know, I'm not going to fault anybody who does, but I mean, there's a lot of baggage out there when you hear those kinds of things. And you don't identify with it yourself, you think, well, then I must not be gay. Well, I just like guys. You know?
Well, that's a good point. The other side of that, too, is that some people hear that and they still say they're gay, but they take on all the guilt. There's two ways. Yes, sir.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And so, like I said, whenever I do run into someone that tells me that my blog was an important part of their coming out process. To me, that's the most gratifying thing that anybody can say.
Well, Jim, your writing is golden. The depth and the clarity, and you must have had an educational background in English at least. Did you train to be an editor? Did you study that in college? How did you?
No, I trained to be an electrical engineer, and then I became a software engineer. So, no, I didn't train in any of the writing sciences. I used to do a lot of creative writing when I was in high school, but I kind of set that aside, and I wouldn't really say that I really picked that up. But, you know, when you're in engineering, part of the discipline is to take some very complicated things and break them down into small, manageable pieces so that you can figure out how to make things work. And you make things work with smaller building blocks that eventually build up to the larger, you know, piece. And so I'm kind of using very similar skills here. I'm taking a lot of material and just kind of breaking it down step by step and saying, okay, this is what they're saying and this is what they're using. This is the research that they're using to try to make the claim that they're making. Well, let's go to that research and see what it really says. It's really very simple. It's surprisingly simple. I was surprised at how easy it was because, you know, you get this notion that professional psychologists and psychiatrists, they have a lot of really big words. They speak in very complex ideas. And you go to a very dry professional journal and you think, well, you know, how are you going to make sense of it? The surprising thing about it is that they are all actually very, generally pretty well written, very clearly written. And I'm finding that the layperson is not going to be too terribly lost in going through it. And then plus my engineering background, I do have a certain competency in statistics and how experiments are designed. And when you design an experiment, well, it's going to be valid for some conclusions, but not for others, because you just did not take those other factors into account when you were designing the experiment. And that's the loophole that anti-gay groups exploit, is that they take researchers' conclusions and extrapolate it to areas that those researchers did not even try to study, let alone intend to make.
Well, that's a very good point. Would you remind us about the Dutch study? Some of the listeners this evening may not remember the show when we talked about the 15 easy steps to writing the pamphlet, and I think what you're getting at is the Dutch study. Is that right?
That's a great example. It's probably one of the best examples. And you'll hear this whenever anybody listens to Christian radio or they go to any of these conferences. Somewhere along the line, someone is going to say something like this: that there was a study from the Netherlands, and they'll always say, well, gay marriage is legal, because they always like to put that in there. And they'll say that even among stable homosexual partnerships, men have an average of 8 partners per year outside of their relationship, and that their relationships will only last 1.5 years. That's the claim. And they will say that this study that's from the Netherlands proves it. Well, I found the study. It was written by Dr. Maria Zerudu, and she works off of data from what was called the Amsterdam cohort studies, HIV infection and AIDS. Right there, that tells you something right away. That tells you it was not a population-based study. It was a targeted study. And the whole purpose of their study was not to examine partnerships or relationships. It was to examine how HIV is spread among a population. And so what they did was they went to all the HIV clinics and said, hey, do you want to be in the study? And they enrolled people from age 18 to 65. But then they decided, well, if someone is monogamous, they're not spreading HIV. And so they explicitly excluded everybody who was monogamous from the study, because they were irrelevant to what they were trying to observe.
Yes.
So they excluded everybody who was monogamous, and they would only accept people who basically said, no, we're not monogamous. Well, when you study people who are not monogamous, you're going to find out what? That they're not monogamous, right? They have
well
another partner. Exactly. The other loophole is that gay marriage, they have a form of partnerships now, but at the time the study took place, which is basically from 1984 through 1988 up through 1995, 1996 time period, they did not have domestic partnerships. So their study included people who had only met for a week or who'd only been out for a month, and not people who had been together long enough to say, oh, we're going to build a life together. And unless you're going to study American couples who just went on casual dates and try to make some sort of comparison, saying that, well, an average relationship only lasts 1.5 years, well, I would guess a lot of straight relationships that have not yet entered the state of marriage have a similar span. So this is a classic case where they took a study that had nothing to do with gay relationships, and they use it as though it were. And they draw a conclusion out of this study that the authors have absolutely no intention of making, that it was in fact completely irrelevant to what they were studying.
Well, the article was fascinating to me, and there was a point that you made that I found fascinating, and once you had presented the point, it became obvious, but it wasn't at a point that I would have logically come upon myself, and that was the point that even the folks who were actually married, that gay marriage had only been in existence there for, what, 5-6 years or 3 or 4 years, and that so obviously no one had been in a relationship that lasted more than 10 or 15 years because, or actually, I think it was quoted much lower, because gay marriage didn't exist.
They weren't really studying people in a marriage-like situation. They were studying people you know, that were in a, what they considered a relationship. Well, you know how, you know, straight people, how many, you go to, think back in college, your buddies, you know, roommates, and how often they dated and how many times they dated. And, you know, I know of people who went through 2, 3, 4 girlfriends during the 4 years in college. I mean, that's not unusual. Well, those gay counterparts of those kinds of things got swept up in the study. They weren't married. There wasn't anything that said that they were building a life together. So the trying to take the people in this study and compare them to married people who had actually made that decision, okay, it's us and it's us forever. No, it is a complete apples and oranges comparison. It is completely inappropriate.
Jim, another article I want to ask you about because it for one, it blew me away that you found this guy, was the story about Zach, the 16-year-old who was committed to a one of the, was it Exodus or I've forgotten the name, but Love in Action, one of the Homo Nomo organizations, and he had begun talking about the rules and regulations of this place on his MySpace page. And what puzzles me is, and I'm not asking how to get in touch with him on the air, but what I am asking is, how in the world did you pull that up? Because the kid's profile is private. You can't even ask him to be a friend, and there's just no way to locate this guy. Do you have a team of researchers or investigators who find these people? I was fascinated by how did you find Zach?
Well, I didn't find Zach. He basically burst on the scene in 2005, and that was really kind of before this website really got underway. So I certainly can't claim any kind of credit for finding him. That story was already out there during the summer of 2005, and I didn't start this until the following winter. So I had to kind of backtrack a little bit. For any listeners that want to know more about Zach, I believe probably Pam Spalding probably has a lot of information on him. Tal LaRogue probably does. You won't find a whole lot on Box Trill Bulletin about him just because he, you know, his big moment in the sun was before this thing started. But you ask about the rules that we found. I actually got them from another former ex-gay participant who had copied them off of Zach's blog at the time. And so I was, you know, you do this a while, you kind of build up a network of other activists and other bloggers that have some of this information. And basically that's how I came across it. And I noticed that not a lot of people had posted it, and I was really kind of surprised at that. And I suspect that's because Zach had posted it, and people just assumed, well, that's where it will be. Well, he went private, of course, and so it is actually kind of hard to find, so I wanted to make sure that it was available, so I did post it on the Box Trill Bulletin.
Well, he was a fascinating young fellow, and I, like Box Turtle, this particular program came into existence June of last year, so we will have run this show for a year this coming month, so it was a situation that I wasn't in tune with when it happened, and I was fascinated to find out how anyone Daniel Gonzalez is he's part of your team there?
That's correct.
Yes. Now,
yeah.
Daniel's been on the show. He was a fascinating guest. Does he work in that area with you? How do you work as a team, or do you work as a team? How does this organization work, and who are your people?
Well, we have Daniel Gonzalez, and he is a former patient of Joseph Nicolosi. Joseph Nicolosi is the past president of NARTH, N-A-R-T-H. That's the National Association for the Treatment and Therapy of Homosexuality. National Association for the Research and Therapy of Homosexuality. Joseph Nicolosi is sometimes regarded as the father of reparative therapy. Daniel Gonzalez was one of his patients quite a number of years ago. The other gentleman that works on the website is a man by the name of Timothy Kincaid. He lives in Southern California in the L.A. area. And his interest is a bit broader and more general anti-gay theme. Daniel stays pretty well focused on the ex-gay aspects of it. And we really do kind of work independently, because the fact is we all have full-time jobs, and so this is strictly a part-time volunteer effort. We don't really have a whole lot of time to try to coordinate between each other. So, you know, I'll be investigating a story, and then before I write it up, I'll check the website real quick, make sure no one else wrote it. And sometimes Timothy's ahead of me, so I'll let his piece go, because he does a really good job. It was really a matter, I think, just of finding the people that you trust and know to work very well, you know, do a good job, and just let them do what you trust them to do.
I see. Well, the another article that we found of great interest was, in fact, we've followed up on it in several ways. We recently had a guest from Sacramento, Jerry Sloan, down in Sacramento, who's Toxin. It's T-O-C-S-I-N. It's a group. It's a website and a group of people who are tracking the movements of the evangelical Russian immigrants from Latvia and what have you, and the Watchmen on the Walls. But we became aware of Watchmen on the Walls through Box Turtle Bulletin, and we began pursuing that with Hutcherson and then more from the fellow Jerry Sloan. Now, that is a fascinating story. How did you get a hold of that? That's and especially the parts that took place over in Europe.
Well, that's an interesting story, because it actually goes back to my my heterosexual agenda track that I know you've talked about with your audience.
Yes,
right?
We do.
I received an email, or when was it? Probably early last year, from an activist in Russia. It says, "I hope you don't mind, but I took the liberty of taking your pamphlet and translating it into Russian." And he created a PDF file, you know, downloadable file pamphlet that looks exactly like mine, except his is in Russian and mine is in English. I mean, he used the same font face and design and everything. It was pretty amazing. He really did a great job with it. And so he asked me if he could post it on my website and also distribute it in Russia. And I just said, well, absolutely. I would love to. So when you go to our website and look for the pamphlet, that's why you see the Russian language pamphlet there.
The I wonder.
So it's a gentleman by the name of Ruslan Porzhnev who had done that. And he lives in the town in the southern Urals of Russia. I don't know if I can pronounce it right. I believe it's something like Chelyabinsk or something like that. I stumble
over all those.
Yeah. So anyway, so he did a magnificent job with that. And in some of the emails, he keeps me up to date on what's going on in Russia. And in the process, he had heard about Watchmen on the Wall. And he kind of clued me in on them about what they were doing, and not just in Latvia, but in Russia as well. And so when I did the series of articles on their conference that took place in Novosibirsk, which is in the Russian Far East in Siberia, Watchmen on the Walls had actually posted the videos up on their website. And then they also posted, when they did another conference in Latvia, they posted those videos up on the website. So I was able to go through those videos. Half of them are in English, because we've got some Americans that go over there and speak. The ones that are not in English, the ones that are in Russian, I asked Ruslan to help out with the translations, because obviously I don't speak a word of Russian. And so together we were able to he handled the translation aspects of it, and then I wrote up the article, and that's how we were able to get the word out what these Americans here are doing in Russia and in Latvia and elsewhere. So that's how I got involved with the Watchmen thing.
It was fascinating, and it especially the video, there was a video where the fellow was translating into Russian. What was that? I've forgotten the fellow's name that was speaking on stage.
Scott Lively.
Scott Lively.
Yeah.
Yes, he was one of them. And then that was fascinating. We clipped some of that audio. Who recorded that? Was that recorded for broadcast over there?
Yeah, it was put up by the Watchmen on the Wall themselves. I mean, Alexei Ledyayev is one of the founders. He is originally from, let me think, I believe he's from Kazakhstan, but I'm not really sure. he's from the former Soviet Union, let's just say.
Yeah.
And he eventually migrated his way to Latvia, which was also part of the Soviet Union. And he's the founder of a mega church there, and they have their own television studios, and they have their own production capabilities, and they put it all up on the web. I mean, it wasn't like I had to go surreptitiously going around, you know, spying on anybody, although I do notice that they made a comment about homosexual activists spying on them. But you know what? When you put your stuff on the World Wide Web, I think that's not quite spying.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the beautiful thing about it, is all these groups, whether it's Watchmen on the Walls or Focus on the Family, I mean, they don't hide what they're doing. It's easy to find. And so you just pull it up and point at it and say, hey, look what they're doing. Isn't this ridiculous?
Yes, the fascinating, and we talk about those things often, and the fascinating part to me was, we import everything. Everything's made in China or Taiwan or Mexico. We have nothing, but it seems to me we were exporting hate. The only thing we were exporting was hate to those countries with the Lively fellows. Was it Scott Lively? I think his name was then.
Right.
And I was just dumbstruck by the whole thing. And it's tied to Sacramento. Jerry was telling us that there are Russian language radio stations, television stations, and they have very, very large, not that there's anything wrong with having a church, but they're very, very large, and they're all rabidly anti-gay, and this is, I'm talking about Sacramento now, that in addition to that, they're all very vocal about the Pink Triangle? What was the book?
The book is The Pink Swastika that Scott Lively wrote. And actually, he's actually getting it translated into Russian. And it's probably, I don't know if it's out yet in Russian or not. He's actually getting it translated. It's a book that he wrote back probably about 10 years ago originally, the first edition of it, which basically says that the Nazi movement was at its core the homosexual movement, and that, you know, that it was a natural outgrowth of what happens when a society accepts homosexuality. That was his thesis. He totally, completely downplays the fact that while gays were being rounded up and sent to concentration camps, it's just revisionist history like you've never seen before. But you got to understand that it's hard. You know, why Russians? Why are they so wrapped up in this? You got to remember, you know, you think back to World War II, there was no nation on the face of the earth that suffered more. No nation, I should say, on the face of the earth that suffered more from World War II, from Nazi aggression, than the Soviet Union. Yeah, I mean, 6 million Jews died, and you know, that was the horror that we all know. But, you know, the Soviet Union was also very nearly obliterated. I mean, the toll was staggering. And that was only a few generations ago. So people today in the former Soviet Union, I mean, their grandparents, great-grandparents survived, you know, what was for them a different kind of a Holocaust. So when someone goes around and says, well, we know who killed all of your family, and it's these homosexuals, and it's a homophobic and a xenophobic society to begin with, it's the kind of thing that really catches on pretty quickly. But it's really sad that the way Scott Lively has been able to very adroitly exploit Russia's history the way he has.
Well, it's a desperately evil thing to do, to transfer the anger of the culture against what happened, towards what happened to them from Nazi Germany. Obviously, isn't there to transfer it to the LGBT community. We often have the argument here: is it Live or is it Memorex? And what we mean by that is: do you think that Scott actually believes this, or do you think that Scott believes it and is ignorant, of course? Or do you think that Scott actually understands the truth and is deliberately doing this to further the anti-gay agenda? We often wonder here how people can be that evil, and we often try to decide if it's ignorance or is it manipulation. What do you say?
Well, I don't know what's going on in Scott Lively's heart and mind, and I certainly have never talked to him in person. But I think most anti-gay leaders, whether it's Scott Lively or Ken Hutcherson or James Dobson or the people at Exodus, they are pretty much true believers. I really do believe that most of them really do believe everything that they say. I think that they also do understand how to make things look the way they want them to look. I know that they understand the tactics of propaganda. But at the core, yeah, I think that they really do believe, for the most part, the things that they're saying. They may understand that, you know, in the particulars, when they take a study and misrepresent it, they know what they're doing. You can't do it by accident, so they know exactly what they're doing when they do that. But they are doing it because they really do believe in the bigger themes that they're really trying to push.
I see. Well, of course, the American Family Association is another one, and we believe Focus on the Family, too. Maintain the huge, the bulk of their income, at least, from people who are helping to fight the gay agenda and the rich homosexual lobbyists.
Yeah.
Oh, by start. So we have to wonder how much. Yes. Go ahead, please.
Oh, I was just going to say, Focus on the Family. Their combined budget is probably about $157 million, which you compare that to the HRC, Human Rights Campaign, they're only about $50 million. But yet, Focus on the Family just the other day complained about how they're being outspent. I just thought, well, that's just the most ridiculous thing in the world. So I went and looked up the tax information, put it up there, looked at the HRC's tax information. Focus on the Family's budget is more than three times the size of HRC. So, you know, this whole idea that, you know, they're being outspent is just an outright lie. And, of course, they know it. They don't care. And then repeat it again. I do want to touch on one thing when it comes to money, though. I have heard a lot of people say, well, you know, if they didn't make a lot of money off of demonizing us, they would go on and off and do something else. I don't believe that for a minute. I have talked with enough of these people to know that they really are true believers. They're very smart people, though, and they do know that if they're going to do what they want to do and do it well, that it does take a lot of money. And so they do make sure that they hire a lot of really good people who know how to raise that money. Now, in terms of raising money, if Bashing Gays didn't raise the money, yeah, they would go somewhere else to raise the money, but it would not change the core focus of what they're doing. They would still fight just as hard as they're fighting today against gay marriage, against adoptions by same-sex couples, against domestic partnerships, against hate crimes, anti-discrimination. They will not let up. I mean, if they figure out how to raise money a different way by, you know, going after abortion, fine, they'll do it. But what they're really doing is they're doing it out of true conviction. And I don't want anybody to write it off as being just, oh, it's just about money. Because let me tell you, it's not just about money. It's true conviction. And if we dismiss it as being just about money, we're underestimating them.
Well, that's a powerful statement. The true conviction angle makes it all the more persistent and all the more intense by creating God's enemy on earth and then saying that God has charged them to combat that enemy. A common enemy rallies people much better than a common.
Without a doubt.
Yeah, and it's always disconcerting to us to to deal with the latest affront. Sometimes we just laugh, and other times we cry. It's a difficult. Yeah. How do you cope with it personally in your own life? Are you able to relegate this, or do you take it personally when these people come at us this way?
It's an interesting mix. Yeah, sometimes I do find myself taking it a little bit personally. I'm usually pretty good at compartmentalizing it off so that I can just deal with the facts and figures. My partner Chris can't at all. So, over the years I have managed to get myself on some pretty crazy mailing lists, let me tell you. And so he'll get the mail, and I'll come home from work, and he'll say, "Your stuff is over there." He'll have my stuff at the dining room table. He won't even go near it because he just can't stand it. He doesn't know how. And he'll say, "I don't know how you even deal with that." So I do have some ability to compartmentalize. But I got to tell you, I mean, there are some things that when you talk to some people, I was in Memphis last February when ex-citizen folks on the family were putting on a Love One Out conference. And while I was there, I was talking with some former clients of Love in Action. And one gentleman in particular I got to spend quite a bit of time with and just not really sit down and grill him or anything, but, just kind of get to know him. And in the course of the conversation, just learn so much of what he went through. And you can't hear those stories without coming away feeling something. The things that they went through are things that nobody should go through. It's just beyond imagination how anybody can defend Love in Action in particular, but in a lot of what goes on in the ex-gay movement. It's just absolutely, it just tears your heart out to hear some of this stuff.
Yes. Both Peterson Toscano and Daniel Gonzalez told us horror stories about that, not to mention the amount of money spent, the travel, the housing, the books, the pay.
Yeah. Well, I talked to one guy. He's been out of Love in Action for four or five years now. He is still paying off credit card debt from that. We kind of had to, pass the hat just so he could afford to come to the ex-gay survivors meetup. We kind of had to pass the hat a little bit and find a place for him to stay. Because he couldn't, otherwise he wouldn't have been able to afford to do it. He's been paying off his credit cards.
Wow. The thought occurs that oft times when someone has experienced fraud, they could contact their credit card company and do a chargeback, or however that works. The credit cards on your company's on your side, but I doubt that's the case.
No, because there's no guarantee. They know not to give any guarantees. It's just, it's for the program, and you pay for the program. It's just like anything. You don't get it. You don't get money back from your doctor if a cure doesn't work. So, there's really very little recourse.
And I suppose one of the outs is that you didn't pray hard enough, you weren't sincere to God, et cetera, is that part of it?
Yeah, all of that, or you weren't honest enough and you weren't dedicated enough in the program. There's a lot of outs. There's more outs than you can ever imagine. But ultimately, it is the responsibility of the individual who, quote unquote, failed. And that's the other thing about this, is that once someone leaves the program, it's like an excommunication. They are, everybody else who remains behind in the program is forbidden any contact with them. They are forbidden contact with any members of the program. There is no follow-up. There's nobody calls them back and say, "Hey, how you doing? Are you doing okay?" There's no aftercare whatsoever. They just turn them loose. I have heard stories of people actually, sitting there on the corner of the street with a bus ticket, waiting to go home, And I also know of one instance where a gentleman was sent to an ex-gay residential program in Kentucky, and when he said he wanted to go back home, they refused to buy him even a bus ticket. They just kind of kicked him out, and this is a guy who had actually was experiencing some mental, emotional problems. And, you know, the irresponsibility of some of these programs is just, you know, just beyond imagination. They get by with it because they're not regulated. They're very careful to say that, no, we're not a psychological program. We're not a medical program. We are a ministry. And as soon as they say that, there is no regulation that can touch them.
Well, Jim, we've talked about the horror stories here about aversion therapy and all the way back into the 50s with electroshock and vomiting-inducing drugs with porn and all the horrible things that people went through. Is there any sort of aversion therapy that's part of these current Christian themes?
No, not that. I have not heard of anything like that going on for quite a while. Now, there, I say that, and I am aware of some Mormon-affiliated aversion therapies that took place in the 1980s. In fact, I know one person personally who underwent aversion therapy, electric shock aversion therapy in the 19... I don't know exactly when, I won't say. No, that is not a part of what's going on in the ex-gay movement today.
Jim, I'm curious about punishment. You know, part of the rules are you should confess to your counselor if you've had any fantasies or any contact or any dreams. Do they pray over you, or do they punish you? Do they take away dessert? What is the way? How do they handle that? What happens if you tell?
Well, it just opens up a round of very intense counseling for the most part. It is kind of weird, though. Now, some of the things I really found surprising, though, is how, you know, they take copious notes, and then later at some other time, they'll pull this information out and use it against the client in, you know, in some of those quote-unquote counseling sessions.
And these are group counseling sessions probably in front of others?
Sometimes group, sometimes individual. The worst treatment. This is the thing that just, you know, I was just fell over when I heard two different people describing this and everybody else that had been a part of it nodding their head. You take a complete and total personal inventory, and this is at Love in Action. You take a complete and total personal inventory of every single sexual encounter you can remember. You write it down, put it in your personal inventory. If you think of more, add to it. You keep going, and it's virtually everything you've ever done. Now, if you want to really think about that, and there's some kids that, you know, some younger ones that don't have much experience, so they have to delve into, well, okay, if you didn't actually do it, what were some of your fantasies? What was some of the things you wanted to do? And then they have this thing called a friends and family weekend, where their parents, usually parents, arrive, and everybody thinks it's going to be a chance to, you know, spend a weekend with your family and have a good time. Well, no, what they do is they pull the family members aside and put them through a grilling, an all-day grilling, of, you know, what made their kids gay, which all has to do with, well, you weren't a good enough father to them, you weren't a good enough mother to them, and these are all the things, and this is why your son or daughter is gay.
I see. And so that also instills guilt in the parent to pay more, perhaps, or to continue. It seems like that's a way to enforce the money coming in. A little guilt there?
Yeah, a lot of guilt. I don't know whether it enforces money coming in or not, but it certainly has quite a tremendous... So, you know, this is something that doesn't, you know, when we talk about the harms of the ex-gay movement, we think about the harms it's done to the clients, but we don't think about the client's family. And so, then they set up this event where they have all the family members in the room, and then all the clients in the room, and when they enter the room, they still haven't had a chance to even so much as say hi to each other, haven't had any chance to speak, but they've got this event going where the gay clients now are in the front of the room, and they have to read in front of the parents their personal inventory.
Oh, Lord have mercy. I can't imagine the violation. I just can't imagine what that must be like.
I was just absolutely flabbergasted. I heard one person talking about this, and I turned to another guy and said, no way. And he turned to me and goes, yeah, that's what they did. I mean, I was just, I couldn't believe it. I just absolutely could not believe it. And before they did this, this is the most humiliating. It's hard to imagine. How do you make this even more humiliating? Can you imagine? Well,
I can.
They found a way. They told the parents ahead of time that their sons were going to be, and daughters were going to be doing this, and that the parents were not allowed to offer any affirmation, that they were only allowed to say, well, this is disgusting. I'm very disappointed in you. So when you think it can't get any worse, love and action finds a way to make it worse. I mean, it just is absolutely beyond appalling. I don't see how anybody can maintain an association with a program like that and hold their head up. It's just an awful, awful thing.
I'm at a loss for words, too. Beyond appalling is the best I could describe it, too. I have the words to really wrap around a scenario like that. Evil doesn't quite cover it. It's barbaric, really, to put people through a situation like that.
And this is a pro-family group.
Oh, my stars. You know, 100 years from now, when we look back on this, hopefully, I can't see that it could be any other way that we look back and, you and I won't. We won't be around, but shake our heads and collective heads and wonder at the pure Salem witch trial, witch hunt sort of feeling that some of this stuff takes on.
Well, you know, it was only 40 years ago that gay men, mostly, some lesbians, but mostly gay men, signed up voluntarily for electric shock aversion therapy to try to change. And that was considered, you know, the most up-to-date, state-of-the-art treatment for homosexuality in the 60s. And, of course, here we are 40 years later, and we think, how can anybody even think that something that barbaric is a good thing to do? Yeah, I have no doubt that 40 years from now we'll look back on some of the stuff we're talking today and future generations and say, what on earth were they thinking? I also, maybe it's me being cynical, but I do not doubt the capacity of human beings to come up with something else. So that's why we need to stay vigilant.
Jim, tell us about Peter LaBarbera. Now, that man is a real work of art. Are you under his radar, or has he attacked you, too? He attacks everybody.
I think he's looking for something. He hasn't really attacked me, no. He's kind of left me alone. I suspect if he found any kind of angle, though, he would go after it pretty heavily. It's just what he does.
Right, and he's always doing everything's a truth wins out sort of thing. We've talked about him several times, but the man really amazes me. But one thing I don't want to miss is you really went into the belly of the beast when you went to the Family Impact Summit in Tampa.
I thought I was ready. You know, after having gone to some Focus on the Family events, I thought, well, this will be a piece of cake, you know, and oh, my goodness, there was nothing like it. I think that was as close to the Belly of the Beast experience as anybody can ever imagine, because you can go to Focus on the Family events, and you can go to Exodus events, and not feel too bad, you know. If you really want to go and find some positives out of those events, you will find them. And I think I've written about those positives as well. I have nothing positive to say about the Family Impact Summit. I can say that it was truly. I mean, this was the. Part of the people who were there were partly the Christian Reconstructionist crowd, but also you had the other end of the spectrum You know, it's kind of funny when you look at organizations like this, you kind of build up a different alternate universe where the left and the right don't mean what they do in normal places, you know. And so yeah. If you really want to think of maybe focus on the family and Exodus occupying a left, quote-unquote, end of the spectrum, well, this is where you really find the far right, some of the people that were there and speaking. It was just absolutely amazing. True Christian Reconstructionists, some of them. And that's not a term that I use very often at all. And I know a lot of people do misabuse that term. James Dobson, for example, is not a Christian Reconstructionist. Now, Alan Chambers is not a Christian Reconstructionist. But some of the people, yeah, they are at that conference. It was just amazing.
Well, that went on multiple days. How many days were you there? Did you survive the whole event?
Yeah. It started, I believe it was on a Thursday night, and it went all day Friday and Saturday. It was a 2.5-day event. Yeah, I stayed for the whole thing. I took pictures and took a lot of notes. And again, it's this kind of detachment thing. It was kind of odd, though, because the other events I'd gone to, it was easy to kind of stay lost in the crowd because, you know, if there's 800,000 people there, well, you're just one guy, you can walk around, you do what you want. Then I had trouble getting people showing up to the Family Impact Summit, and I would guess that there were probably only about 250, maybe 300 people max. There weren't that many people there. And so during lunch break when I would go and they had lunch on the premises, I would get my little, you know, lunch, my little tray of food, and go to a table to sit down, and pretty soon I'd be, you know, other people would join me, because that's what Christians do. They fellowship.
Yes.
So
how horrifying.
Yes, moments where I felt a little uncomfortable and wasn't sure, you know, what I should say or do, so I just kind of I'd keep quiet.
Yeah.
But,
You know, this took place in Tampa. Some of the listeners may not know. It took place in Tampa. What was the facility like? What sort of a place were you in?
Well, it was at a church. It was a fairly good-sized church that also had a Christian school. And they actually had canceled classes at the Christian school for the day. I believe it was a grade school and a high school combined. And they canceled classes for that Friday. Because it was taking place all day Friday and all day Saturday. And we met in classrooms, basically, in the sanctuary, of course.
There were workshops and lectures. What particularly was the worst moment?
The worst moment probably was, I'm going to have to pick a couple.
Exactly. I was afraid of that.
I got to figure out how to narrow it down. I think it was all the workshops were kind of awkward because I would be there with maybe 15 or 20 other people. So probably the worst moment for me was when I wandered into one workshop and I was one of only about 5 people there. Well, now that was awkward.
Yeah.
Because then they would want to, you know, when you have that a few people, well, why did you come? Why are you here? You know.
Oh, my.
That was awkward. But, you know, it was most of the time I was kind of able to just kind of sit back and be as invisible as I possibly could and just take notes. Because one thing I did not want to do, I did not want to be there as a participant and, you know, ask questions or engage in any conversation because I didn't want to inject myself into it. I saw my role there as strictly as an observer and as nothing else. And, you know, and as you start
in engineering background speaking, I love it. That's well said, yeah.
Yeah, you know, that was my role, to be strictly as an observer. And if I'm going to start engaging, well, that changes the dynamic. And the last thing that I wanted to do was change the dynamic. I didn't want to set people on edge. I didn't want people to feel like they had to be on guard for saying something that, you know, they might otherwise not say. And so, you know, I tried to stay as absolutely as quiet and as you know, unobtrusive as possible.
I see. Nonetheless, did Chris come along and stay, like, off-site? Or
no.
Did you all have to stay in the same hotel? What was Chris's reaction?
No, he stays home that? When I do these things because, you know, it's an all day, these are all-day events. And I mean, I always, you know, I thought, for example, going to Tampa, well, I'd have some time before and after, see some sights, get some decent seafood. And I had no time whatsoever. I mean, it was getting up in the morning from the hotel, you go straight to the conference, you stay, and it's an all-day thing. When I get home, afterwards, I'm exhausted, so no, there's nothing else going on. I mean, this is really nonstop work. It's not a vacation at all. And so we would never see each other. And, you know, so no, he stays home.
I see. So the Family Impact Summit, then, can you at least, can you, is there a way to summarize it? For instance, its intent, was it to plan the conservative agenda? Was it mostly about the LGBT community? What was the scope and who was there?
It was mostly about the LGBT community. The idea being is to provide quote unquote education for the participants about what the gay agenda was all about.
Oh,
of course, Alan Chambers that was there. Actually, quite a number of people from the ex-gay movement was there to say, well, you know, there's no such thing as you know, truly gay people, but it's nothing but an identity and a behavior, and we can change, and we're living proof. So it was all about, quote-unquote, education of the homosexual lifestyle and all of those things. Now, it wasn't exclusively anti-gay. It was also anti-Islamic. It was also anti-abortion and those other things. The gay agenda, as you might put it, did take up an awful lot of their time.
I see. Speaking of the gay agenda, I heard a couple of days ago through the for-profit media, we started calling it the for-profit media rather than the mainstream media. We just have started doing, think that might be a better description. So in any case, I just found out for the for-profit media, we're not supposed to talk about gay marriage so much anymore. We're supposed to talk about our straight allies. Have you heard that command from the high-ranking generals of the agenda?
No, not really.
Okay.
I think there is a certain, but I think there is a recognition that, you know, when people go after our rights, that there's collateral damage. And I think we can see that a lot, especially in some of the anti-marriage amendments that go up across the country where, you know, they take an aim against same-sex couples, but there's a lot of unmarried straight couples that get caught up in that dragnet. You know, in Ohio, there was they tried to throw out domestic violence laws against unmarried couples, straight couples even. And, you know, where, you know, two people living together, if the guy beats his girlfriend, that there would be no recourse under the domestic violence law. The Supreme Court eventually did decide, no, we're going to keep the domestic violence laws just the way they are. But, I mean, these so-called family advocates actually tried to get it declared unconstitutional. So, and this was a law that was set up to protect straight people. So, you know, that, there are a lot of people that get caught up in the dragnet. And so it is appropriate to talk about how when they come after our rights, they're also coming after the rights of an awful lot of other people because, quite frankly, it's true, and people need to know it.
Well said. Well said. And we just saw that. I believe Pam Spalding covered it the other day. Wasn't it Iowa where the university was attempting to extend insurance, I believe it was. And I believe the way Pam put it was you could hear the great exit of the educated faculty members to another state. I think it was Iowa.
Yeah, and Michigan has had a similar ruling. So, you know, they're going after gay people, but they don't mind the other collateral damage because, after all, they're not married either, and they're living in sin. So, you know, they don't have any. They don't have any problem with it. But if they get upset when we point it out, they say, well, we're just raising an abstraction, because they know that a lot of straight people don't like to hear about it, that how it might affect them. And they do get angry. I mean, that's exactly how the Arizona marriage amendment was defeated 2 years ago. But because it was straight people that understood, hey, wait a minute, this is going to affect us. And
well spent.
Yeah.
Well spent.
When you go after one minority group's rights, you can never actually just, you know, cauterize their rights and leave everybody else's alone. It's a shotgun blast.
I completely agree. Now, Jim, we've been posting your website in the chat room for the benefit of the listeners who are not in the chat room. Box Turtle Bulletin is located at boxturtlebulletin.com, and it's an easy site to navigate and well laid out. That's boxturtlebulletin.com, and I highly recommend it. Jim, I can't let you go without asking about the story of Paul Cameron at the supermarket checkout. Now, that is a story that flew completely over my head. None of the listeners know about this, at least to the best of my knowledge, and I can't believe I missed it. Would you tell us the story of Paul Cameron at the supermarket checkout?
Paul Cameron, you know what? You've caught me flat-footed, because I'm not remembering that one.
well, apparently it was, from scanning it today, it was the article that National Examiner, and it was about gay serial killers on the cover. And it had all these gay serial... it was a study of 518 sexually tinged mass murders in the U.S. from 1966 to 83, and they all practiced as in witchcraft. They practiced homosexuality, et cetera, et cetera. And it's got Gacy and Dahmer and all the big stars, the serial killer. That completely blew me away. Cameron is really scraping the bottle of the barrel. I understand he's even paying to have his own research published, that nobody will touch it.
Well, yeah. He's always, everything he's ever, I had forgotten about that. I'm glad you reminded me that the supermarket, it was on, what was it? I forget the name of the rack.
I believe it was National Examiner, and the way you put it is that it's the National Enquirer's dumber sister.
That's right. Yeah, National Examiner. I forgot all about that. Boy, that's a pretty good memory. It was just a really good example about how some of this stuff just ends up out there and people take it for granted. Just about everything he does has been published in the paper. It's a journal called Psychological Reports. It's a pay-to-publish journal. It has a modicum of peer review, but I suspect what it is they pass it around. People say, oh, okay. I don't think it's very rigorous. It's unusual in that they charge authors to get published. Very few journals do this. Almost no reputable journal that I'm aware of does this.
Yes, it's pitiful.
And so when you're charging the author to get published, well, you know, that sets up a conflict of interest right there, because you don't want to actually turn them away or you lose his money. So I said, okay, we'll publish it. Then they pretty much publish just about anything that's submitted to them. I suspect Paul Cameron might be running on hard times, because he hasn't published anything in Psychological Reports since 2005. Maybe he can't afford the fees anymore. I don't know. He's tried to start up his own electronic online journal, which I point out that the rest of us call that a website. But anyway, so he set up what he's called an internet-only journal. It has been a long time since I've even checked it out, because it's been so essentially worthless. He's calling it the Empirical Journal of Same-Sex Sexual Behavior. He loves the word empirical. It's pretty amazing. He just absolutely loves that word. So he uses it.
Yeah, it sounds like this kind of word.
But last I looked, and it's been a while since I've looked, and I'll have to admit that right up front. But the last time I looked, there was maybe about two or three or four articles maybe posted on his online journal. And guess who the author of every single one of them was? Paul Cameron. He can't even attract papers.
Yeah. Yeah, so someone was going after him. I believe he's
he tries to give the impression that these are published by reputable scientific review, peer review publications, and in fact, he's at the point. And you know, one other thing we wondered about: how did religion impact you growing up? Jim, did you come from a particularly religious family, or did you have to battle that too and work that out for yourself?
That was a big thing to battle. And I want to say up front that, you know, other than, you know, issues surrounding my sexuality, my religious experience was very, very positive. And so I'm going to be the very last person in the world you'll ever want to turn to bash Christianity. I grew up Roman Catholic, went to Catholic school for the first 5 years of education until my parents just simply couldn't afford to keep us kids in Catholic school, and then we switched to, you almost heard me say Protestant school, public school. In my hometown, that's what we called it. In my hometown, that's what we called it. But, you know, I was an altar boy throughout most of my childhood. The priests at our parish were friends of the family. The nuns, you know, loved them dearly. You know, when my father died when I was in college, they practically moved into our house and took care of us for a week, you know, while family was coming into town for the funeral and all that. I mean, I'm going to be the last person you're going to go to if you want someone to bash Catholicism or Christianity in general. However, you know, let's face it, the Pope and I have a very serious disagreement on a few things.
There have been a few things said lately,
And so, you know, and giving up, feeling like I had to give up something that was deeply meaningful and important to me was a very difficult process. And I feel like I have had to. I do know that there are a lot of gays and lesbians who do continue to go to church every Sunday, who still participate. I don't anymore, but that's just me.
Well, I think it's wonderful that you were able to glean some fond memories of that, and that you still have some of the joy of the remembrance. And I think that's spectacular, actually. It's so hard for us to keep our faith. Whether we attend church or not really is not a definition of keeping faith. I will point that out. But some of us do, and some of us are completely destroyed by it.
Yeah. And you know, and I think that's something that I really wish Christians who are anti-gay could really understand is that most gays and lesbians have had such an incredibly negative experience from their religious faith that they don't come near it, absolutely will not come near it, that it's toxic to them. And, you know, if Christians were really concerned about reaching out to gay people, they're doing it in the worst way possible, because they're, you know, they're truly losing people forever by their actions, by some of the stuff that they're doing.
I agree. One wonders if, you know, a large number of the LGBT community seem to be a little bit unaware of how intense the battle is with the church, and I can understand not wanting to hear it after having been beaten up by it throughout your entire childhood and growing up.
Yeah.
If you were, yeah, I can understand the resistance to even wanting to say the word.
Well, it makes perfect sense. I mean, it becomes one of your many strategies of self-preservation, because there just comes a point when, you know, there just comes a point in your life where you just have to say, you know what, I'm not going to take this anymore. And so once you cross that point and say, no, I am not going to take being beat up over who I am anymore, then it's really kind of a remarkable breakthrough for a lot of people. And they're left then with having to rebuild, well, who am I and what do I really believe? And that's a long process that many people, you know, spend a lot of time trying to go through, and many other people just don't, you know. So, you know, it's something that cuts both ways for different people.
Jim, point of curiosity, did Chris grow up in the Catholic Church too? Or are you a mixed marriage?
No, he always joked with me. He didn't really, I don't think he really grew up churched, but his family was Church of Christers, so he had a whole different view of
things. What an interesting flavor that is, that particular mix.
that is quite an unusual mix.
God, I have some hysterical moments as these things
I don't think, because it wasn't that, I don't think it was as big a part of his life as my growing up in a religion was of mine. His family, I don't think, were all that church-going.
Well, Jim, I have thoroughly enjoyed your being on the show. You've been an absolutely delightful guest. We've kept you for quite a while, and I don't want to close without just opening it up to you to comment on current projects or things that I might not have asked you about that you'd like to perhaps bring up of fundraising for the site, anything anywhere you want to go.
Well, I always want to point out that when you see something that's loaded with footnotes, that I always say that, they put those footnotes in there to make things look very official and very well researched. Well, footnotes, quite frankly, are my best friend. I'll go and look those up, and I'll go find out what the stuff really is. And if it weren't for footnotes, I'd have a much harder time at the job that I'm doing. So, don't be bamboozled. Don't be afraid to go look things up. It's so easy, incredibly easy. If you think something doesn't sound right, chances are it's not. Just go to the library. Libraries are a wonderful tool. There's a lot of knowledge in there, and that's really where the power is.
Well, Jim, please know that that Strictly Confidential relies on your site and the quality of your work, and it's deeply appreciated by both myself and the listeners. And we stop by you and Pam and all the other. But when it comes to pure depth, Vox Turtle Bulletin is the place to go. It's just amazing. And it's not just you either. It's Daniel and Timothy. I think it's Timothy Kincaid.
Right.
And it's just,
yeah,
it's
they do
well
a wonderful
done.
Job. They do an absolute. I get kind of jealous of some of the stuff that Timothy puts up, and I think, wow, why didn't I think of that? But he
Yeah. Well,
we all have our very, I think, unique different talents. Daniel is very good about bringing out his own personal experience into some of the things he does. He works more in the video, YouTube kind of thing. He doesn't do much writing anymore. He used to do a lot more writing than he does now. But he focuses more on sort of, using his own experiences as example, and that's a very powerful thing too. Timothy has a great way of really breaking things down to such simplicity that you just kind of scratch your head and think, what were they thinking? So I'm really happy with the people that are working on the website. I think they do a marvelous job.
Well, Jim, again, thank you from the bottom of my little Strictly Confidential heart, and I have a feeling we barely scratched the surface. We'd love to have you back again at some point in the future.
Oh, yeah, well, I'd love to be back.
Just okay, and to consider us a friend, and we'd
all
love
right.
to hear from you anytime.
I will. Thank you.
Thank you, Jim, and good evening to you. Dear friends, that was Mr. Jim Burroway. Now, Jim Burroway is the founding editor of VoxTurtleBulletin.com. And what a remarkable man. Has an engineering background, and he is able to go into such great depth dissecting this right-wing propaganda about ex-gay therapies and it's a myriad. The man is really very astute, and thank goodness for people like Jim Burroway who take these things into great depth. And I tell you what, we've rambled on for quite a while. What we're going to do is we're going to visit the gay bar across the street. Now, we won't be able to run the entire set, but we will run the set up until the end of the show. Now, this evening's gay bar across the street DJ is Mr. VJC, and we all know and love. Hello, VJC. And interestingly enough, the mix that VJC has put together, he chose all Larry Sanders remixes. So not only are you hearing VJC's mixes, you're hearing Larry Sanders remixes. And so it's a new mixed set of remixes that you've not heard before. So it's a lot of fun working with all these people and getting to hear this music. So without any further ado, let's pick up our raincoats and our umbrellas and all of our little pocketbooks, and let's have some fun.
Across the alley was the Paradise Dance Hall. Evenings in spring, they'd open all the doors and windows, and the music would come outside. Sometimes they'd turn out all the lights except for a large glass sphere that hung from the ceiling. It would turn slowly about and filter the dusk with delicate rainbow colors.
Hello, it's VJC for Strictly Confidential Radio. And Peter Godball, kicking the show off with Sarita and La Fire 1980, rebuilt by Larry Sanders. Enjoy the ride of memories from back in the day, 70s, 80s, and beyond. This is VJC. Hello. We'll be right back. Voyage. Souvenirs, check out the remix. It's a non-stop mix. Yours truly, BJC from New York. H-E-L-L-O. Hello, it's BJC.
Thank you, Victor. That's VJC at disco935.net, disco935.net in New York City. That's Victor, the amazing VJC. That's a wonderful set he put together. It actually runs 22 minutes. We didn't get to the whole set, but what I'll do is I'll put that in the Play It Later stack. In a few months, I'll slip it on you. You'll never even know you heard the beginning of it. And all is well. I went and checked the front door. I will say the doorbell is one of those radio ones, you know, the ringers, and then there's no wire to the... And so maybe it was the Agent Fred satellite, but anyway, the beginning of the show was a little subdued because I was listening very, very closely for the front door to get kicked in or someone to come pounding on the window. I just didn't know. The doorbells simply do not ring on the dirt road at 9 p.m. when it's dark. Really threw me for a loop, but all is well. I want to tell you that the horn section is coming up. Myself and Mr. John Fox from Australia and Mr. Bob Kincaid from up there in those hills and hollers in West Virginia will be coming right along at 11 p.m. Eastern Time. And following that, the live programming is not over. We will have Mr. John Fox with his own show, All Foxed Up, that starts at midnight Eastern Time. I'm not sure what time it is, Australia time. It could be in the afternoon. It could be tomorrow. I'm not sure. John can keep track of it. I certainly can't. Want to tell you that I've had a great time this week and look forward to seeing you tomorrow night. Tomorrow night at this point is a Just Us show. We'll be talking about what if 5.3 million more Americans could vote. And in closing, here's Cynthia Manley reminding you, too.